Well, Pierce asked me, Pierce said to Python, but I wouldn't explain it in Python. And he had good reason, he didn't say to Python on the back end. And he also asked me to talk about quantum criticality in that talk. And I was, it's not an entirely trivial way to do that, but I will manage. So quantum mechanics. At some point, I looked up where mayonnaise comes from, and it's an important lesson because it tells us all what matters in this world is war. There's these islands in the Mediterranean, Mahon, and the French were at some point occupying it and celebrating it. And so the chef of Louis de Richelieu in 1756 had invented mayonnaise because it was born in Mahon, Mahonnaise. So that's where it's from. Without war, there would be nothing interesting on this world. It's a clear message of this statement. So what is this? And it is basically, and this will be then kind of defining what the rest of the talk is about. What we are doing is we're taking butter. And we are mixing it with a polarizable liquid. In that case, it would be vinegar. And we all know what is going to happen in this case because this will rapidly phase separate. And in order to prevent that from happening, what we need to do is we need to add egg yolk to the system. And
is this properly spelled?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And what the egg yolk does is, we all know this kind of, I still want to summarize this, that there's lecithin molecules in there, which have these polarizable heads and these oil chains. And they, of course, like to exactly sit on an interface between a water and an oily, or polarizable and an oily system, and therefore they will initially wet the interface of the phase-separated system, but if I add more and more of that substance, there will be artificial interfaces formed, because I'm gaining so much energy of having interfaces, and then I can get all kinds of structures with many, many interfaces in the system. So the emulsifier, if you wish so, manages to mix two phases in the phase separation, then it's on some intermediate link scale, and this is of course interesting in physics. The subconscious matter community has worked of course extensively on this problem and on emulsions and so-called macroemulsions, but the difference is mostly the typical length scale on which this phase separation takes place. Good.
Now the only one is what's in the egg yolk?
An emulsifier. Well, one point which I'm trying to make, for example, is, let's assume we're looking at a Mott insulator. And here we also have indication that there may be phase separation, where we have one phase, say, the doped holes, and one case, let's say, the region which are not doped holes. And again, naively, you may expect there will be global phase separation, and as in this context, Emery and Kempinson pointed out, this can't be, because there's a long-range Coulomb interaction. So the photons will basically play the role of the emulsifier. And you can then ask, what is the difference and what is the new physics related to this problem? So this is why it's called quantum mayonnaise, a quantum system with kind of similar underlying physics than what we know from mayonnaise.
Do you want to try to make the notion that a gauge theory can be an emulsifier?
Well, I'm certain of that statement to be true, but that's not what I'm going to talk about. And that actually are the so-called Vera agreed papers on which basically say that already.
I'm curious.
I don't need to do this. So, now, let's come up with a very simple toy model. Maybe one more motivation also. There are two motivations for us to do this. Initially, really what we were very intrigued by NMR experiment which were done by Chris Hamill and Nick Kerr at Los Alamos at the time, and they were earlier experiment by my colleague Ferdinando Bolsa in Ames, and they all kind of found a very beautiful result that in these high TC systems there is at low temperatures a very slow dynamics which very much looks like in the glass. And what was interesting about this dynamics was that it didn't seem to depend what they did to their samples. It didn't seem to depend on the details of the disordering in the system, yet they always found some glassy type physics in a low temperature regime. And a number of interesting NMR signatures for that. Then there came Christos.
Over a wide open region?
Oh, yes. And then there came Christos Panagopoulos, who does millions of experiments.
Could you put a few names of reference?
Oh, yes. This is Bolsa, and then this Kuhl and Hamill.
And then there is. Of what year? Kuhl and Hamill.
Man.
Did I see 99?
99, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is, maybe you know this better.
Oh, that sounds about right.
Is it the experiments where Barbara Simrich was involved?
They were later, but they were looking at the same stuff. They were looking at how to characterize the dynamics. In fact, this theory which I'm going to present to you gives us a critical experiment, which is 0.9, and what they measured was 0.89. So it may even be true, right? At least your target's moment, right? This is the Simon. But I'm not going to talk about this today at all. Then there is Takashi Imai also, who basically also worked on this problem. And then there is Christos Panagopoulos. This is all NMR. And then there is Christos Panagopoulos. Who has used our experiment. And his experiments are interesting because he could identify this glass transition temperature. He found that it actually seems to vanish right underneath the top of the superconducting dome. And what he also did, he added deliberately impurities to the system, zinc impurities in that case. And what came out of it is that very slight increase in this glass temperature takes place, yet this point here is entirely unaffected by whether I do or do not have zinc impurities in the system. For me, this is some very vague indication that impurity is not really the crucial story here. There may be something which is more generic than that is the just built. Good, so this is to the
glass. This is where? In which
material? This is in lantern floating copper 04, and there are also mere experiments in the YBCO systems. Mm-hmm. So it is. Everything is much stronger, much more pronounced in the lantern system, which may just be we're running after something which is entirely irrelevant for me, the generic stuff. But, yes.
This is basically the endpoint being under the optimal doping TC is only further than 214, right? But it goes further to the left.
Yes. I personally believe, that's really only a belief, that this Bobinger physics where you have a logarithmic upturn of the resistivity is somehow closely related to this low temperature physics here, that you have a kind of glassy state. It would be a very interesting experiment to repeat these Mühlenauer experiments in the so-called single-layer viscoelastic material, because there's something interesting in this. We are getting too much into details of the material, but just to comment on it. This is the point where you find the so-called linear resistivity, and it is the point where the insulator metal transition at low temperature in the field takes place. In the single layer viscoelastic material, these two points are not the same, which means these systems the system physics doesn't need to be related to each other. And I want to know, I think the single layer viscoelastic here is where the logarithmic upturn takes place, and I suspect this will be the glassy regime.
Do you have this characteristic difference between nickel and zinc impurities also in this transition, or is it?
I don't know the answer to that.
There was only one, probably only one.
Yeah, I just don't know the answer to that. So, Panagopoulos didn't look at this problem, but I don't know whether anybody else really looked and analyzed that. I suspect not. I probably would know. Good. So now, this is one motivation, and another completely different motivation was in in this very, very beautiful experiment on MNSI, which is a helical magnet. And so this was, this goes back to, of course, Christian Freider and Lazarevich and von Willenhausen. I always have to look whether there's an H.
Doesn't matter.
There is an H.
I'm going to do this. Okay. I'm sorry about that. That's a guess. Anyway, these are very, very beautiful experiments. Now, this is a helical magnet. It is presumably helical because of the Joseph Spinorin direction. It's a very long pitch. And this is the second order phase transition. These are 30 Kelvin. This is 12 kilobar. And at some point, this transition seems to be coming first order. And what is most intriguing about the material is that there's a regime here where you have a resistivity which goes like T to the 3/2. I wish I had an explanation for this, I don't. But I will still, so that's just to avoid confusion. There is this, what we, I have a suspicion what we need to do in order to get there, like many others. This material was an interesting motivation, because you will see that there is some formal similarity between them. So this is a moon thermal eclipse here. Good. Now, so far about motivation and definition of what this is. So let's introduce a simple model. I want to model, and particularly in view of this one or this part of phase separation. How would I do that? I would introduce a scalar order parameter. I have two phases where I say the order parameter is positive or negative in either phase. I can, this could, for example, then be oil or water. It could be holes or no holes. And there was a recent paper by Jean-Pierre Wong at Caltech, who basically just took our technique, which I'm going to discuss now, and looked at black hole polymers, which are these polymers which are glued together by covalent bond, yet they don't like each other.
Is it real or complex? Fine.
It's a scalar object.
Real, okay.
It's an Eisenberg.
Real, okay.
Yeah. So.
Well, is it 1 or 0, or is it, or 1 or minus 1, or is it...
It's minus 1 or 1.
It is.
Well, I'm doing the soft spin version of that.
So it's pure phase or something?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Well, if it was mixed phase, then 5 would be 0 at that point. That would be locally average it up to 0. Good. So how would I describe that? If I just want to have phase separation, I would just write down an ordinary Ginzburg-Landau or a Landau function for this with the additional constraint that the average of this quantity over space is, say, 0, which is the only addition to the problem, to the ordinary theory. So, in principle, there's no reason to neglect the cubic term in this description here, and we have looked at this, but just for the sake of simplicity, I'm skipping it here. It's interesting physics, but I'm not going to have time to go into all of that. Good. So this is the model, so we can guess what the solution of this model is. If this mass here prefers an ordered state, this constraint, however, doesn't like to have either everything positive or everything negative. The system will put a domain wall in the middle and have one phase as A and the other phase as B, global phase separation. That's what this little time model gives me, of course. So now this is this situation.
Excuse me. It seems to me that it depends on kind of the surface energy of the domain wall.
Right. So, and of course, we want to have an effective theory when this becomes negative. Mm-hmm. Right. How do we get there? And so, one way to do this is to say, well, there would be some long range direction in the system. Which is basically either the consequence of, say, the air gap in the system or the Coulomb direction between the holes and non-holes. And all what I will require for this long range direction is that it at least in some part decays like a power rod. And we have looked also in the case where it's screened, and I can comment on this in a second later on. And when the exponent alpha is at least smaller than the dimensions of the system, is indeed long range. It's a typical long range direction. All of that comes down to that you fully transform this problem. If then singular Q is zero. Yes.
In the condensed matter systems of interest, what is the physics of that zero integral constraint?
Oh, just charge conservation. Say my variable is the deviation of the average Hoyle concentration in, say, a coupe plate.
So it's a charge density fluctuation.
Yeah, basically, since by definition you say it's a deviation from the average, and you say there will be somewhere more than the average and less than the average, you will still have to hit the average when you go average over space.
So phi is a conserved quantum.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's charge neutrality, right?
Just charge neutrality. Yeah. Right, exactly. So now, as soon as I, for example, add a long range Coulomb direction, I don't even need to worry about this anymore, because the charge neutrality will be guaranteed anyway, because I have a long range Coulomb direction.
Just going to be concentration.
Right, it's a definition of what you mean by deviation, right?
Right, exactly. Since it's a deviation from the mean value, it will have to average up to zero. Right, but just, there was a specific example. Yes, it's not deep. Good. So now, this is, of course, the interesting part. There's a normal direction of the problem. Let's look at an example. What can happen if I, for example, take the situation of Coulomb direction, where alpha is d minus 2. So basically, in three-dimension, I have 1 over x, right? Then I can write down the quadratic part. So these three terms easily in momentum space, and we will see exactly what happens. There will be a propagator of this type. And I wrote a prefactor already to match dimensions, so these are all momentum squares. So this will be kind of the Gaussian term of this problem. And now we obviously see what's going to happen. This term really doesn't like inhomogeneities, this term loves inhomogeneities, right? So they have to find a compromise. The compromise will be that the correlation function will be peaked at a typical momentum, which is just given by that, by the length scale up here, right? Which is the strength of that Coulomb direction, if you wish. So what is, however, very interesting about this simple model is that the phase space of these low energy excitations and all momenta which have a certain lengths are soft in that sense. So this is not constrained on the direction of Q of the momentum in the way I've set up the problem here. All momenta which have the length of a Q naught will be equally soft in that problem. So therefore, this problem maps onto a well-known problem which just goes into the Navier-Brazovsky model. Who basically in a very long time ago, in a very beautiful paper, looked at a model where you have a propagator of this type. Which is generically the same universality class. You have soft modes on a sphere in Bose space. This is different from what we know from antiparamagnetism, so we also have a soft mode and a finite momentum, but yet it's only one momentum or a finite set of individual momenta. Yet here we have a real sphere, right, of low energy excitation. That makes the problem interesting.
Could you say a word about how this relates to the Emery-Kivelson instability, which is, of course, a striped instability rather than a
region?
So that the characteristic Q only occurs in one dimension.
Well, what did Brzozowski show in this literature very, very nice paper? He said, well, look at this problem. Let's do a Hartree-Fock calculation to learn something about this problem. And then I can answer that question. So if I do a Hartree-Fock calculation, what do I need to do? I need to calculate. Let's do a classical calculation. I need to calculate the order parameter fluctuations, and that will be just the integral of all momenta. Of this type. So now, since this is a finite momentum, phase space just doesn't matter. It's effectively a one-dimensional integral, so it gets me one of those squares of R just by doing the integral. Because it's technically, I can shift the momentum by Q naught. Phase space is Q to the D minus 1, which we know so much, so important for all the dimensionality dependence. All disappears, so we have one of those square root. So the order parameter fluctuations are huge because of this space. Well, then you can just compare when is the Gaussian term comparable to the nonlinear term, and you find this gives you a typical length. We just insert that coupling constant to the two-thirds power. And this is where the system just undergoes a fluctuation just to its order transition into a state where it just picks spontaneously one ordinate state into one specific coverage. So, as a fluctuation, and the solution is just one given momentum with that length spontaneously chosen. The system cannot go through a second order transition because you just don't find a solution this where the mass can be zero. The system is not defined for zero mass. Not even Gaussian calculations are defined. You cannot have a second order phase transition. The only way you can enter that problem is through a first order phase transition. And that will be the solution. And that is, I think, the kind of striped solution, every memory kills and find out. Good. All that I'm going to say is, this is only half the story. This problem by itself, and because of its large phase space, is extremely sensitive to disorder in a very beautiful way.
But before we go on, though there's obviously a length scale in the Coulomb problem, is it obviously equivalent to the Brzozowski description at long distances? I mean, one's repulsive, one's attractive, so in some sense.
Take this, propagate and draw it, right? It will be zero at Q equals zero. I'm just taking the inverse of this function, just drawing it, right? The inverse of this, because Q is zero. That's my picture, because it goes like, at large momentum, it goes like, 1 over q squared because of this one, because I'm looking at the inverse, and here it goes to 0. And it's going to have a peak in between. The width of the peak is just controlled by this number. And as soon as this length scale becomes large, I can ignore all these details here and the details here, and I'm getting into the same generic universality class. So only at long wavelengths will this problem be the same. In general, it won't. For example, at high temperatures, this problem is just device-free. Right, and but then there will be actually a Lifshitz transition at lower temperatures, and then the system falls into this class where it has modulated solutions.
Okay.
So only the low temperature regime.
So it means when you have the screening, which is only affecting this small Q region, it wouldn't matter either. Right?
Well, you can just analyze how this, well, the Fourier transform of this object looks in real space. And there are two regimes. One where you have exponentially decaying option with a screening length characterized with screening, and at low temperatures you have oscillatory solutions. And which regime you are just depends on all these two typical length scales here conspire to each other. With low temperatures, indeed it is associated with the Darby class, but only at low temperatures in particular. But see, you can just repeat the fluctuation-induced first order transition calculation, and then you get the same anyway.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so I want to reiterate on this question. So the characteristic U is Q0 because you balance Q squared and 1 over Q squared, okay? So I just wanted to kind of get some idea of dimensional units for different models. So what is actually the scale of Q0 for different, you know, implementations? For example, say, if you consider, for example, this magnesium, whatever, silicon stuff. Okay, so in this case, Q0 is just it is just the period of the density.
In that case, in the M with I case, I will, this is not the right derivation to come to that model, I will have to have a helical model.
Yeah, so you have this model right away.
Yeah, so I have it right away.
You don't need this long range Coulomb interaction, because there is no actual charge fluctuation.
Exactly.
Okay. So in case of, say, cuprates, for example, then it is driven by charge fluctuations.
Yes.
So what's characteristic scale U0 in this case? So how big should be, you know, this, well, what is the period?
Well, of course we don't know, right? What you need to know is what is the prefactor of the of this term graph, which I have set one generously. So then, if you say, well, this is of the order of a typical interatomic distance, right? If just in order to say something, and then you just assume here an ordinary dielectricity function, then I remember I've done this really 2 years ago. I've done this with, I mean, exactly this problem because it's interesting. You need to be in a regime where the Coulomb direction is very weak in order to have long distances.
Yeah.
Which is,
I think it boils down to some variable. For example, we can consider a simpler model, just two-dimensional electron gaps.
Yes.
Okay, so in this case, you can have charge, you know, because of the Coulomb interaction,
yes,
you can have charge fluctuations. And then there is only a parameter RS, I mean, there's no other parameters in the problem.
Yes.
Okay, so it all boils down to some RS and some power or something.
Correct.
So, and the only wave vector is KF, and Fermi wave vector. So I think this vector would be k Fermi times some power of RS.
Yes. And I did answer this, and I have a little LaTeX file on my computer.
My question is
this question.
Microscopic, you know, is the length scale microscopic like atomic classes? Or it's long range, that's what.
Well, it depends on the polarized, but you can always tune the dielectricity function if you want to.
Okay.
Right? And this can get me anywhere where I want to of the problem. Which is, I don't know the answer.
Right. May I ask a question, Jörg?
Yes.
So if you consider a magnet, say, it would be much more complicated because you would have a vector, that's the magnetization, and you would have also the directional dependence.
Correct.
But in principle, it would be the same sort of treatment. You could cast it in the same sort of treatment, in the long-range interaction being just a dipolar interaction between different domains.
Yeah. One has to be a little bit careful because it's a dipolar interaction, and therefore this exponent here is cubic. Therefore, you really are, for example, if I wanted to look at it at series magnetic multilayer physics with that approach, then this function, the potential only diverges logarithmically at small q. And whatever cuts it off has an easy way to go to destroy the physics I'm going to talk about. Because dipole interaction is still not exactly what we want as a long-range interaction. But yes, you're right. In principle, this can, if I have, for example, these domain physics of Fermi-mating multilayers, where some of the glassy physics has been seen, actually, if you look at the rawlers. But I have always stayed away from this because I'm only living in a logarithm. In principle, yes, this should work.
But also, you could actually have the pitch of the helix.
As
the order parameter, and the
If you do this, then of course, what you everything comes from the fact that in addition to an ordinary vectorial Ginzburg-Landau expansion, you get this term, Ginzburg-Maria term, right, which is magnetization cross gradient of M. And if I now look in the paramagnetic state, what are the modes of the system? I get three paramagnetic modes. And I'm getting a longitudinal mode, which goes like Q square. I'm getting a left-handed helical mode, which goes linearly in Q1. But I'm also going to get a right-handed helical mode, or whatever that sign determines, which is a mode which is soft on a sphere in that case. So I can get away with an Ising description if I project the physics at low energies exclusively on the left helical mode. Because I will just ignore that the helix can change its helicity. Therefore, the vectorial physics actually dies of that problem. I can get away with the scalar description like here.
So do you assume any limit for R0 and Q0? What's the relative?
Well, in the end, we will have to see, we have to fine tune the system in order to be close to a transition, right? So that's where I'm going now.
So you don't consider either the case R0 much more smaller than Q0 squared or much larger than Q0 squared?
Well, this is a bare mass, but I, of course, want to have the normalized mass of this problem to be close to criticality and want to see what happens under those situations. And that's what I basically said here, that's what Bradovsky answered this problem. If the renormalized mass of the correlation length of the system is longer than a certain distance, the system will not sustain that fluctuating state, but it will actually lock itself into an ordered state by a fluctuation due to first order transition, which is weak by first order. So what I want to study in this model, how much do I have left?
Well, you've had 30 minutes.
10 minutes.
So, no. So, we've been asking questions all along, so questions are mixed in with it. So you have another 45 minutes total.
Oh, well,
so you're completely done, but that's really the end then.
Yeah. So basically, this was all of what I've told you so far.
So you're halfway through.
Yeah, all of what I've told you so far has nothing to do with me personally. It's all known before I even looked at this problem. I didn't know about it, but so what I want to study, what is the role of this order? And what is the role of quantum dot functions?
Before you're about to rub it off, you've written down Charles and Maria terms. There's a lattice. I'm trying to make it into a vector.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, not anymore. It's too late.
No,
I think we should. Yeah. Okay. So we got the original part. Exactly. The first part was
So now you have to give the 2 minute summary.
Yes. The Jarlusinski Maria.
Yes.
There's a lot of it. So I'm just trying to make it into a little scale.
Okay.
So grab it.
It's just, I guess you find it similar to all of the other
ones.
Good. Now, disorder. You can introduce two types of disorder in this problem. One is, you can assume that the system has a random mass. We studied this problem, and the result is not particularly interesting. The result is that you need to have a critical disorder strength, and which is determined by the strength of the interaction of the problem. If you exceed that disorder strength, the system will, the first order transition will disappear, and you will go into a state which is glassy, behaves generically like a spin glass, and you will find the distribution function of the disorder will become strongly renormalized, which is an interesting byproduct of this exercise. But otherwise, since you need a critical disorder strength in order to get to new physics, it is at least not as beautiful as the second case, which I'm going to discuss now, which is...
Is it the strength relative to the fourth order?
Yes, exactly.
To you.
The reason is when you do, say, replicas, and you always get from a random mass, you get another 5-4 term, and they talk to each other. And that's what it's kind of about. Now,
this can be done from just looking for replica symmetry breaking.
Well, we did it two ways. You just do replica symmetry and analyze the replica structure of the problem, or there is a renormalization group type of approach for these type of models if we look, and I'm going to discuss the clean version of that later, and then it might be useful to look, when I can comment again how it works. So the more interesting case is random field disorder. And this is also very, and let me give you the result before I even discuss.
So what does it have up here?
Oh, you just add.
So it's like Cartesian technical potential.
Correct. You just add a Gaussian distributed random field problem with strength G to your problem. You just add it. So now what we found is that this system undergoes a glass transition, and this glass transition survives in the limit where G goes to zero. So this is, we all know that random field disorder is important, and that in some cases, well, you get strong thing flow, but sometimes it only changes critical physics. But yet you still have equilibrium physics governing the behavior of a system if you have a small disorder. In this problem, the random field disorder, even though infinitesimally small, drives the system immediately to non-ergodic glassy state. So this is the interesting result of the calculation.
So the Bayer theory is a critical glass. It's critical to a glass condition.
Correct.
So I can understand this qualitatively. So suppose you don't have disorder, then you don't have density wave transition.
Correct.
You don't touch the mode, right? So once you put disorder, you might imagine this electronic crystal lattice would be disordered, meaning that, you know, vectors may change, you'll be
changing
defects and so on. There will be no long range periodic order, but there will be short range periodic potential,
yes.
Right? So is that kind of glass that
correct.
You get? Okay, that kind of glass that you get. So it's disordered electronic lattice.
Correct. Yeah, you have on a short distance over this periodicity characterized by this momentum which we just introduced. It is just you cannot sustain this object to survive over the entire system, but you will have patches of regions with the direction of that preferred ordering vector just varies in space.
Dirk, you had time to explain why that's true, why it's a critical glass.
Well. What I thought I'm going to do is to show you how we did it. But then you actually have to do integrals of self-energies and solve a number of nonlinear equations and in order to actually see that. And I've spared you with that, but that might have been...
what qualitative feature it means is, I mean, it looks like everything's massive, you've only got the direction or cue that's soft.
Oh, system. Yes.
What enables it to respond to this very tiny amount of...
Yes. It is the large phase space of the sphere. Without that sphere, if this Q naught goes to zero, which a limit which you can very easily take in the Coulomb situation, we recover a perfect equilibrium phase transition, which is second order. And as soon as we are going away from this Coulomb, and add this tiny Coulomb direction, no matter how small, if it's long range, it will always give you this glassy physics.
And the second or first order glassy transition?
The glass transition will be a so-called random first order transition. So it's a discontinuous jump of the Edwards-Anderson order parameter without latent heat. So it is neither nor. That's called the random first order transition.
You know, there are a lot of interesting experiments and controversy about the random realizing model.
Yes.
That's without this long-range interaction.
Right.
But it's a very interesting system. Is there some obvious way to introduce the long-range interaction? It's an interesting experimental system.
I wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I told you the answer, the statement is, even if G goes to zero, the system will have a glass transition. We used three different techniques which all give identical results, including all the factors 4 pi and so on, in order to find this result. One technique is, you just do what I just told you. we add this random field to the system explicitly. We do ordinary replica theory. We need to break the replica symmetry, the one-step replica symmetry broken state, and so take at the end of your calculation the minimum g goes to zero, and you find that there is that the glass transition temperature actually does not vanish. This was the calculation number one, the replicas. Then we did a second calculation where we did this Schwinger-Kelbisch moon equilibrium dynamics. What you do here is you start at infinite temperature, you quench your system infinitely rapidly to a temperature below your alleged glass transition, and you look at the long time correlation in the system. In this calculation, you have no randomness whatsoever in the system, but you have history dependence. And you find that there is a finite correlation even at very long time in the system, which survives if you're below the glass transition temperature, which we also found using the replicas. There's dynamics. And then there's a third technique which we actually used initially and first, which goes under the name of cloned replicas, which you may not so familiar with. And I thought I'm going to tell you something about this because it's a very beautiful technique, which was introduced by Rémy Monasson.
Maybe I misunderstood the first statement. I thought originally it was a critical theory, but now you're saying it actually has the clean theory has an intrinsic glass temperature.
Where did I say it's a critical theory?
Oh, I said, and you agree.
Okay.
I said I misunderstood.
Okay.
So you're saying that the clean system is an intrinsic glass with a finite glass temperature.
The clean system is sensitive to an infinitesimal amount of disorder. That's what I'm saying.
But the glass transition temperature doesn't go to zero.
Doesn't go to zero as the randomness goes to zero.
So it is a glass,
right?
Yeah.
So it's not sensitive to an infinitesimal thing. You will just do it anyway.
But you need to be careful. First of all, there is no such a thing like a glass, except for Meade theories. So all glasses are metastable states, and the system will have to get out of there. And it's an interesting discussion, how are you getting out of there? And that the system will eventually always crystallize to what is best energetically. This will be the Brzozowski solution, I'm sure, in this case. So all these statements I'm making are kinetic statements, right? The glass is really something we're getting stuck into immediate theories forever, in reality not forever. So that's just something we need to keep in mind.
So you're saying beyond mean pure theory, this glass transition might disappear, come across a slow.
There will be some very, very slow, say, coarsening type physics or something like that.
Right? But without a time scale that diverges.
Yeah, there is no. I at least believe there is no really divergent time scale. It's just always longer than the age of the universe in occasion. But it's technically always finer to go to an ergodic state. Right? And so in this system, because it's so soft, it will be faster than the age of the universe, I'm quite sure, to recover equilibrium. So there were simulations on this model after we have done that, and different groups don't agree whether it goes to an equilibrium state or not. Many groups say, yeah, this is exactly what we see. And there's a very nice book from David Reichmann and Philip Geisler, and they found that this problem it has some very interesting, very, very slow dynamics, which is very nice. But in the end, it seems to go to equilibrium eventually. And I don't fundamentally disagree with that it's a very nice job. But what it says is some slow dynamics. I believe this slow dynamics, the end mean field theory, is probably what gives us, I hope, the key to this we have in the eminence side. But that's just wishful thinking. I want to go on and just tell you something technical, I thought, because it's theoretical physics.
But is it the age of the universe or the age of a graduate student?
Well, they're not much different on a log scale.
Even for practical purposes, they are. Yeah.
You said while you were addressing this,
yes,
that you get basically density transition because of the large phase space, right? And
yes.
Because we basically consider the sphere.
Yes.
Now, if I look at MNSI and I look at the fluctuations on the relevant mode, then I know that it's actually pinned in certain directions. So if you now introduce some anisotropy on the sphere, How will that affect basically the scattering?
Very good question. If this is, we only need to have a certain proximity to criticality. The correlation length in these systems never actually diverges. But all the critics happen at some critical value, just like what I had here earlier. So you just need to have arcs where you don't see that they actually condense into a point on the scale characterized by this correlation length. Then you're fine. So if it is easy to move out the helix out of its preferred direction, I have a space where on my typical energy scale it just appears to me that it was circle. However, if I need to, if I actually could condense into this mode, then it's a different story. So it's a very good point. And there is of course a critical anisotropy beyond which all this here disappears. Like,
will you get back to the word quantum in this discussion?
Yes. Good. So I thought I'm going to tell you this. If anybody, shall I do that? It's technical.
Well, it's just a question of whether you'll ever get back to the quantum fluctuations.
Yes, I will. But
okay. Given the actual time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. So the idea is this. You want to take, the idea in its logic very similar to how you look at magnetism. When I have a magnet, a ferromagnet, I have two states. If I average the magnetization over all possible configurations, I will get this magnetization, this is probability 1/2, minus this, or plus this magnetization, with opposite sign, with a probability 1/2, so the total magnetization will be zero. How do we solve that problem? We apply a small external field which biases this one over that one a tiny little bit for an infinite system. This will be infinitely many, this will be a huge energetic favorite, therefore we pick out only one of these two and we get a non-ergodic magnetization, simply because we ignore the fact that the entire phase space is being explored in the system. So therefore we are losing a piece of the entropy. Our actual entropy is by log 2 smaller than what the ergodic entropy should be of the problem. But that is no problem because the entropy is an expensive quantity. Losing log 2 really doesn't matter. In a system which wants to become a glass, however, the system is really different. Here, the landscape may rather look like this. And in this case, I have metastable states which under certain circumstances can even be exponentially large in the volume of the system. And if this is the case, and if I'm now getting trapped into one of these states here, because the barriers are larger than the temperatures, then of course calculating the partition function like this implies I am scanning the system over all these states. Yet I never visit most of them. Therefore, I'm clearly making a mistake in calculating the equilibrium partition function. What I should do is I should confine myself to this regime. If I'm getting stuck, therefore, the free energy, I call it F bar, of that typical frozen state will in general be the equilibrium free energy, which I get from here, and will be higher by an entropic term. Because all these entropy associated with exploring all these other options is lost. Where the configuration entropy is just the logarithm of the metastable state in the system. So therefore, if indeed there are exponentially many states in the system, then even taking its logarithm gives me something which is proportional to the volume, which is therefore expensive. And this is bad news if I want to do a thermodynamic description of the problem, because I'm losing an extensive piece of my free energy. Therefore, I have to do something else. How can I mimic this physics of where I had basically external field applied in order to select a state? And if I have a glass and I'm suspicious about having a glass, then I need to have an external field which biases certain amorphous configurations in the system. And this is being done by adding to our action And just for generality, I also do this for a quantum problem as well. I'm adding to my action an additional term. You didn't know that the time changed? I add that term, and this G will eventually go to zero. This field here is a static field, and it just picks out certain configurations of my actual mode phi of x and tau, which can be a quantum mode in general. And
phi and dot, or just phi?
Phi.
It looks like phi and
dot. Oh, no. That's an old one. So clearly, this new problem, which has now two variables, I can now calculate the partition function parametrically for each of these test configurations. Psi. So now, which are the configurations which contribute most dominantly to this partition function? And those are clearly the metastable states of the system, because metastable means it minimizes this one. I'm sitting in some saddle locally. And if psi equals phi, then I'm also minimizing that one. So if psi equals metastable state, then that's good news for the problem. So therefore, I'm interpreting this free energy as the typical free energy of the metastable state psi. Now I need to know what is its distribution of these metastable states. And the assumption is, well, the best thing to determine the probability distribution is just to say that the metastable states are characterized by a Boltzmann distribution. Now, in quantum systems, however, one has to be very careful. What does that mean? This is, if I were to be at t equals zero, this procedure would only give me the lowest in energy metastable states. They might be all a tiny little bit different in the energy. If indeed t goes to zero, this procedure would select only the lowest metastable state. That is unphysical. So it doesn't need to be the actual bath temperature, is the statement, which distributes this, but what is called an effective temperature, which has been introduced in a different context, also in the dynamical description of these glasses.
But should we now think this is just a phenomenology?
At this point, it's a phenomenology. And the only justification of that phenomenon is that there are two other methods which I can derive. All, look at this as the interpretation of the first two calculations which I haven't given you.
Okay.
Right? Because they all give the same answers. But I think this is the most physical interpretation of what's happening in a glass, even at t equals zero.
Sorry, only depends on x.
It is not. It is a static variable.
It should be static.
It is a static variable, and the argument is that metastable states are static solutions. They're really static solutions, and we are currently actually thinking of giving this a time dependence and how to do this properly. But that's another story again. Good.
I'm confused.
Yes.
It seems to me the system does choose one of the metastable states, and that's the nature of metastability.
The system will choose, but the probability which one I'm choosing is another story. What I want to know is, there will be a spectrum of minima here, right? They will all not be have the same actual energy at the bottom. This is basically the effective temperature. What I want to do is, since the individuality of one given metastable state is really something I can't do much about, I want to average over all of them. And I want to see if I average this free energy over all of them, it should still be different than the equilibrium energy, because I'm losing configurational entropy. Even the mean value of all these energies should be just comparable to one individual value, but it should not be the equilibrium free energy. But in the end, you can only look at mean values. If you do and maybe next order fluctuation. So now, if I now want to look at the this problem, then this is my mean free energy. And the way, if I now insert this P, is e to the minus beta f, which is nothing but z to some power. Which is just the ratio of these two temperatures, the actual temperature and what I just called the glass temperature, right? The z gives me the free energy. Now I'm putting this back in the exponent. Here there's a real t, and here there's a d factor. And since it's so conveniently in the exponent, it's just another power. So what I need to calculate really is something like this. And that, of course, is now a replica theory. But I just do this. And then I'm going to get z to the m log n. But just doing the derivative of it. So therefore, there's also a nice physical interpretation for this. If I write all of this, not in terms of this replica index m, but actual t effective, for example, what I find then is, if I look at the configuration entropy, which is just p log p, I can write it as like in the thermodynamic regime, that the configuration entropy is kind of the response to this effective temperature. So I think the physics is this. Take a piece of silica, which is an amorphous state. The atoms are random. If I looked at them, they look like at high temperature. Because only at high temperature are they actually supposed to be random. At low temperature, they're supposed to be in the crystal. The temperature, basically where the system froze, is what this temperature is. It is just the temperature which tells me that the system hasn't managed to relax back. This is the characteristic temperature which tells me what is the width of the spectrum of states which can potentially contribute to the problem. Now you have a replica problem, and now you can analyze this replica problem, and you find that you can now, we solved it with two techniques. One is a large N expansion of the phi field, and the other one is a dynamic mean field theory of the Ising-Dirac theory for you. Both give identical results up to numerical prefactors. Yes?
Here you eventually average over possible low energy metastable states.
Yes.
But as you were saying, I mean, the system actually doesn't, if you take an experimental system, the only way I can see in which the system actually averages over all metastable states is that in one sample there will be a lot of those metastable states appearing with some domain walls between them.
Mm-hmm.
But then the dynamics of the problem would probably be the dynamics of the main walls trying to swallow one state or another.
Even if the system is only in one meta, but I didn't let you finish. Why don't you finish?
No, okay. So I'm just trying to understand. Once you do the calculation, in the end you do an average, you get some quantity.
Mm-hmm.
Those quantities, what do they relate to in an experiment? Average over many samples, single sample?
There is one way, even if the system only picks one metastable state, how you can tell whether it does or not by doing a calorimetric experiment. You can measure the entropy, right? If, for example, I look at an ordinary liquid solid transition, I have, this is my entropy of the solid, the biphysics. I have a melting transition, and I have the entropy of my liquid. If I supercool the liquid, which I always need to do in order to get to the glass, my entropy is this one. These differences here, this is the additional entropy I have because in the liquid I'm exploring states, in the solid I don't. This is essentially of the same order of magnitude than my configurational entropy. As I now get stuck into one metastable state, I will immediately lose all the translational entropy. Therefore, my entropy goes down and gets to something which is a glass, it's a little bit higher than the crystalline solid, but eventually only has harmonic vibrations. Because the atoms getting after they've gotten stuck just vibrate a bit. So this is basically our configuration entropy. The difference in the entropy between the ergodic and the non-ergodic motions of particles. Now, if this definitely depends on the cooling rate of the problem, it's a kinetic problem. What I'm doing is only the following. I'm trying to classify of whether the system has such a configuration entropy. And then I can use all these words I'm just doing in order to tell you, well, then it will get stuck at some point in one of them. But first I need to specify of whether there are so many metastable states to begin with. Good. So we have now done that.
20 minutes.
Yes. We have now done that. And we have now replica theory. We've analyzed the replica theory with several techniques. And what we find then is that if I take my variable Q naught and temperature, and this, then I have a glassy regime at low temperatures, which after it's done, the limit G goes to zero. This temperature here is just the temperature where the system, the original Phi-4 theory, has a mixing demixing transition. So my phase separation, which I started off with, will at some high temperature, because of entropic reasons, mix. This temperature is this temperature here. Then if I now switch on this long-range interaction term, I'm getting a glass transition, and the order of the glass transition temperature is given basically by the demixing temperature. The temperature I want to form locally ordered structures. The configuration entropy in this case, which we find out of this calculation, is very simple. It is extensive, so exponentially many states. L is the system size, length. And it is proportional to this Q naught. If I have very, very long modulations, I have only few states, because Q is small. This is only a packing problem of domains of modulated structures. That's period, that's it. So I have somewhat extended regions of modulated structures, and they just have to be packed somehow. And those are the metastable states. If there is additional dynamics beyond that, it will be the movement of compact regions, which is giving rise to anything beyond the mean field physics we're discussing here.
Now, what is
D? Dimension, yes. Because L to the D has to be volume, sorry. It has to be dimensionless here. So, now, Pierce is very impatiently waiting that I finally talk about quantum.
How do you actually determine your
Oh, very good question. There are various ways to do that. You just say, look, I quench a system from large temperatures, and then I have what is called a marginality criterion. So I want that at least my fluctuations in replica directions are marginal, so the eigenvalues are zero. This gives you one value of this effective temperature. And then you can This gives you a large configurational entropy. And then you can basically wave your hands and argue, well, this may cool down because I have exponentially many states if the system kind of breaks up into domains and locally explores more states, and it can cool down. And there are all kinds of descriptions of this. But the initial effective temperature is given by the argument that you say, well, it should be so-called marginal. So you don't want to have it unstable into replica directions. That defines it. What is interesting, though, is that even at T equals zero, remember M, T over T effective. The effective temperature, you can only make sense out of the entire theory if, in the glassy state, the effective temperature stays finite. So a glass at T equals zero in this mean field logic is a state of classical metastable states. It's not a pure quantum mechanical state characterized by identity matrix. It's a mixed state where you're mixing states over a spectrum of this T effective. So this effective temperature stays finite as T goes to zero. So you're mixing up a number of states. You don't go to the lowest state because it's all kinetics. Now, quantum effects. we add to our action a quantum term, a dynamical term which we choose to look like this. And just to look at 2 over z. So z equals 2 would be a ballistic quantum dynamics, z equals 1 would be an overdamped quantum dynamics, the other way around. Z equals 2 would be an overdamped quantum dynamics, and z equals 1 would be omega squared, and you would have a ballistic case. Yes?
Just to be sure, once we have dynamics, since we consider Coulomb, say, let's say Coulomb interaction, can they cover the plasma frequency? In the spectrum of charge excitations.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So if you take this omega, equate to that part, it's Q and Q and recovers. Yeah.
So,
in the systems we're familiar with, overdamping comes from people underlying physics, namely.
So if I'm, for example, in MNSI, then I think I have conduction electrons in the paramagnetic state. So then I would say that overdamping just by particle-hole continuum of the conduction electrons. In the cuprates.
But that alludes to particular geometry of the Fermi surface, etc. So
you
need your modes to fall into the particle-hole continuum.
This is my Fermi surface.
Yes.
This is my MNSI thing. All I need to accomplish is that I go from the Fermi surface to the Fermi surface by transferring my momentum Q naught, right? And I always have enough phase space for that to do. I got my little surface, which is say my MNSI sphere, and I got my actual Fermi surface. And kinematically, I don't see any argument as soon as these two length fields are considerably different, which they are, that I can always draw that picture. EVC function is much more realistic. So in that case, I'm actually not worried about this. In the ordered state story is different, but we'll be looking at just a paramagnet, if you wish so. Good. So what happens, first of all, the glass temperature of the system really decreases. And
what's on the x-axis?
There has to be a prefactor here, right? And that prefactor, if it's large, means that I have no quantum fluctuation. If it's small, I have quantum fluctuations. So this is one of a gamma then.
Right.
Yeah?
And this is for which z case?
Yeah, I'm coming to this. This is, if you look at all z which are smaller than 3, which are all relevant situations, I can come up with. We find that initially, at this temperature here, we have what I discussed earlier as a random first order transition. So a transition where the ergodicity breaking, this would be long time correlations, jump discontinuously, yet there's no latent heat. And then the transition will be first order. It will be first order, and here, this transition here, the glass transition, where you have a discontinuous jump of the effective temperature. That was first found off in a different model of a random spin, of quenched random spins by Letizia Cugliandolo and collaborators. And this non-random problem is in the same universality class than those problems. So you have this discontinuous onset of glassiness. Now, basically I can tune the height of this temperature by changing my dynamics. As z reaches the value 3, just as a formal exercise, this point goes to 0. And I'm actually having a quantum critical point of the glass system. Now, since I can tune this to small values, I can also look what happens at these temperatures up here. So first of all, what happens here is I'm melting the glass. And I'm melting it by quantum fluctuation.
So then that's gamma, not mandela gamma.
Probably, let's see. If gamma is
gamma equals zero after the original physics you discussed with
them. Oh, gamma equals zero, I can violently fluctuate my time-dependent action.
Okay.
I want to suppress the fluctuations. I cannot. The gamma equals zero limit is not the classical limit. The gamma infinity limit is the classical limit, because then I will not have time dependent.
Okay.
So, is this including tunneling facilities if you have the 19 model?
No. What we did, it's a very interesting calculation. You can't say, well, I have metastable states, many metastable states.
That's why.
They can break up in space. And yes. You have exponentially many metastable states in a finite region. So then we map this problem onto kind of a tight binding problem in Fock space. So you could have, these are all my states. And I can look how can I tunnel from one state to the other. And the energies of all these states are random because of the glass. And you can map the problem on localization. And I think probably the most honest picture of glassiness in quantum system is clearly the localization picture. You're asking, can I be localized or delocalized in Fock space? If I'm in a glass, I'm localized in Fock space, I'm only exploring a few of them. If I'm delocalized, I'm not. So what you find is that you have exponentially many states to go to as far as your volume is concerned. So in the Fock space picture, you have exponentially many neighbors. In the volume. On the other hand, you have an exponentially small tunneling rate, because you have just have a droplet going to another droplet. Any instant on calculation gives you that the tunneling rate is small in the volume, exponentially small in the volume. You have two exponents which fight, and there's a number. At some point, then you get a transition between these two states. So what I was hoping is that would give me an answer very different from this one. But it gives me an answer which parametrically is the same. And therefore, I'm close to the transition in some of the arguments which I'm making here are just not really right. I think it's, so you can do tunneling physics, but it doesn't really accelerate the melting of the glass, to my personal disappointment. Good. Now, what is interesting now with respect to quantum fluctuations is another issue. If this point is low, I can still find a regime where the system is essentially quantum critical, because the first order transition will be arbitrarily weak. So. And we analyze basically this regime where we are sufficiently far enough. This is actually out of scale. It actually sits somewhere here, the region where we get a very small effect. I think it's fundamentally important to have that effect, because you can't easily go from a glass to a liquid by a continuous transition if it's the glass of this universality class. There's a brick wall in between. Yet you can tune this to a small value. So now, in the last 5 minutes, I'm going to discuss what happens if I'm above this transition here. This problem has nothing to do basically with glass physics. All I need is to go to the equilibrium description of the problem, because I'm above the glass transition temperature. Now this is my sphere.
All of this relies on really long-range interactions, being able to use mean field type methods,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes. Well, this is a little bit more ugly, I think. Even though I'm starting off with a long-range interaction, since the system organizes itself into this modulative structure, it very efficiently screens the long-range interaction, of course. So therefore, I'm stuck with a short-range interaction in the end of the day, which is nothing but saying, look, I can map it on the Berdovsky model. There's nothing really long-range in there if you look at it. So then I don't really have the ultimate justification for my mean field theory anymore. Right, so it's actually worse than that. But here I have now ultimate and infinite control, because I have a sphere of low energy excitations. And Shankar told us how to do a renormalization group on a sphere. In that case, it was for fermions on a Fermi surface. But it is straightforward to copy-paste all the important physics here. In this context, that was done already by Pierre Hohenberg and Swift a number of years ago, where they looked at a completely unrelated classical aspect of this problem. So we just stole their ideas and quantized the problem and did it in this case. So what do you have? On the finite sphere, in the fermion problem, we have basically BCS scattering, where we have two momenta which are anti-parallel, and we have forward scattering and exchange scattering. Now we have a scalar order parameter here. Therefore, we have two coupling constants. One is a generic angle between the scattered momenta. Since I always have to wind up on the low energy sphere and do the same geometrical construction I need to do for fermions.
This is the Q-naught sphere?
This is Q-naught sphere. This is Q-naught. Yeah, it's not the kind of thing. So, and then I have another scattering channel which is generically very different. Where all momenta are parallel. This is a measure zero set of all the other coupling constants. Yet it is the only coupling constant which couples to the order parameter of the modulated state. In that sense, it's very important. Good. So now, the system, because of this funny momentum integration I told you, is effectively d-dimensional, dimension is one. Just like fermions. Looks like one-dimensional physics. However, I have this exponent z, which characterizes the dynamics. And just like in Hertz-Mills physics, we have an effective dimension which is 1 plus z. So therefore, I can now an expansion, an epsilon expansion around z equals 3. This problem is indeed marginal at the upper critical dimension if z was 3. And so we have these two coupling constants, and you can write down their flow equations. And it's just counting phase space that you find that, say, if I call this coupling constant lambda average and lambda parallel, that lambda average is just epsilon lambda average plus minus lambda average squared. The ordinary flow equation you would get for a 5-4 theory in without this, all that stuff, where just what you change is 4 minus e pi by 3 minus z. And this coupling constant since it sits on a measure zero, doesn't renormalize anybody else, but it's being renormalized by that other coupling constant. So this too makes a big difference. You can solve these flow equations fully and completely, you find following flow. That's a fixed point. And this is the flow trajectory. This fixed point is a tricritical point, simply because I need to tune two parameters in order to reach it. One is the mass, I need to be on the critical surface of the mass, and in addition, I need to tune, for example, one of these two coupling constants. This flow is nothing but our just discussed fluctuation-induced first order transition. Because the coupling constant runs negative, I can make this very specific. If my flow goes to reaches the negative sign of this coupling constant before scaling stops. I use this as a criterion for the first order transition. I'm getting exactly the same result I would get from an equation of motion, which I would from the equation of state a la Bravosky. It's the same physics. This here is a strong coupling fixed point, of which I have not much knowledge of, because I have no reason to believe that it remains first order. And what I can do is, of course, I can write down kind of an effective mean field theory at this point, which is the point where I only take these couplings into account, the momentum couplings, which are all parallel. If that is correct, I can solve the problem exactly, and it's a problem in its lower critical dimension, in z equal 2, where I have marginal momentum modes. So if I knew anything else about this problem, I would be very happy. So I invite everybody who has something intelligent to say about what to do about this point to discuss that with me. That point here, we can do a perfect scaling analysis. We find unconventional critical exponents. We find that there's a specific heat. Divergence C is C over T divergence, like T to the minus z minus 1 over z, we find that the NMR relaxation rate T1T diverges with the same exponent. We find also that we are coupling now fermions to these modes, that these fermions themselves become non-Fermi liquid. Unfortunately, they don't become Fermi liquid in the way we wish them to be, namely giving us a T to the 3 half resistance. But that would also be only at a critical point, which the MNSI story doesn't seem to support anyway. Yet, it gives us even worse. It gives us a self-energy, which is omega, say, to the z minus 1 over z again, which is a square root self-energy imaginary part for z equal 2, which is clearly non-Fermi liquid. Again, there was a very nice paper. We were on it. Yakovenko, Shubukov, Galitsky, who looked also at the crossover from momentum dependent to the frequency dependent self energies in this problem, and this is basically the critical point you have been looking at. You didn't say it because you probably didn't know it, but this must be the critical point you had been in must have had in mind for your theory to work. So there is non-Fermi liquid in this problem because of the coupling to this low energy mode. However, unfortunately, it is too bad to explain all the beautiful MNSI experiments. It is too much non-Fermi liquid, if you wish to. Yet it's a very nice model you can study. What my suspicion is maybe there is an interesting phase up here. What does that mean? I have a coupling of parallel momenta, which is getting stronger and stronger, so that it's not such a good news anymore to put the system into one helix, because it costs a lot of energy to all put all momenta into the same direction, even in equilibrium, never mind the glass of physics. So something else will happen where I don't have one preferred direction in the problem in order to gain that energy. So there's a lot of energy because this happens for large energies if this reaches a critical point. So therefore, this is a beautiful model, I think. It has this glassy physics, it goes through a non-ergodic state without doing anything about it for an infinite amount of disorder. It has non-Fermi liquid physics. It's a rich model, and there's still quite a number of things which we don't understand. Thanks a lot.
Question.
I have one. So, which relates to the question that Pierce asked. So, if you are in a paramagnetic state, remember, I asked regarding this overdamping force. Then, if you have free charge carriers, regular Fermi surface, then probably your Coulomb also gets screened. How do you reconcile that with the Berezovsky spectrum?
Yes.
Maybe I missed something, but...
No, you can answer this problem. We have, this problem with the temperature versus this typical length scale, right? Doing this phase diagram, here we have a vanishing configuration entropy, actual second order phase transition, here we have a glass. This is the typical length scale, the strength of the Coulomb interaction. You can now add to the system a screening length. The glass transition will vanish. And there will be, and this is just the inverse screening length for the pure divide of Fermi or something. So, if you have a very, very short screening length, which you will have in a good metal, you can forget about it. If you have a poor metal where you have a large screening length and the screening exceeds this typical scale, you're still in business and nothing really changes. Yes. So, which is not really surprising that this happens in these two limits. You can.
So, one might say it might apply to dilute Fermi gas, yes. Like for example, two dimensional reaction gas like semiconductors.
Yes.
But the concentration is so low that the screening gap is so large, and then it might apply. If you have a wood metal, you know. Then that
doesn't work. Well, I mean, and the gallium arsenide, you have large epsilon, so that also works.
Yeah, that's also true. Epsilon also helps.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thanks very much.